and in the joy of this scent post-haste for the court wizard. That wizard felt Rusalka's pulse, tapped her knees, looked down her throat, peered into her eyes, and counted her teeth. Then he pronounced a mighty spell over her. Nothing happened. Then the wizard tried necromancy, chiromancy, geomancy, alluromancy, and megalopolisomancy. Nothing worked. Rusalka kept writing on pieces of paper, "I am not an enchanted land princess. I am an enchanted sea creature. Please leave me alone." But nobody paid any attention. The wizard could read, but only a little, and he couldn't make sense out of her handwriting. So eventually all her written materials were taken away from her on the grounds that compulsive graphomania, scribbling all the time, was part of the spell. Other wizards were sent for. The prince scoured the length and breadth of the land. Rusalka tried to escape out the window of her room, but they caught her. Then she tried to barricade herself in her room, but she was constantly watched. It's notable that the spell the sea witch had put on Rusalka so easily couldn't be taken off by even the greatest land wizard. But finally the prince sent clear to Transylvania, which means across the forests, for the greatest land wizard of all. He was an old, old man with an immensely long white beard, a fearful temper, a long blue gown, and a conical hat. He was exactly what wizards are supposed to be. He knew at once that he was faced with a fantastically powerful spell, but he also knew how to remove it. He had Rusalka brought naked before him in front of the whole court, and said to her, she had gone past the stage of biting people and fighting, she was now very tired, "We will make you into a real woman." She wrung her hands. "Yes, yes," said the old wizard, "I know you don't like being what you are. I know that you are strange and sad and cold." Rusalka fell to her knees. She meant, "Let me go back to the sea," but of course nobody understood her. "Yes, yes, we know that you want the spell removed," said the old wizard. Rusalka opened her mouth to scream at him, but no sound came out. "Yes, yes," said the old wizard soothingly, "we'll fix all that." From his pouch he took out a white powder, which he had spent all day preparing from his magical equipment, his flasks and tubing, his fires, his knives and staves, his pieces of dead animals, his gunpowder and mushrooms. He flung the white powder at Rusalka, and immediately she was enveloped in a pale cloud, like the fog on the sea at night. Though through it the prince could see something shimmer and change. He waited eagerly for the cloud to disappear and show him his beautiful human bride. But when the cloud did fade, and he saw Rusalka at last, she didn't look beautiful or human to him at all. She looked like a giant frog. The prince was shocked. He thought Rusalka was a she-demon who had enchanted herself in order to destroy him. He thought her green skin was horrible and the webs between her fingers and toes disgusting. He thought her gills were a lace collar until they began to open and shut, and then he realized they were a part of her and turned his face away. He couldn't bear to look at her. Later on, he would realize what he had done and would feel profoundly sorry for Rusalka. He was a good man, and the idea of a sea maid dying for love of him gave him no pleasure. Only when he was very old and getting a bit silly would he hung himself in secret and say, "I am the only prince in the whole wide world who had a sea maid die for love of him." He would marry, of course, not just because a prince ought to, but because he would want to. But he would have a memorial built around the goldfish pond, with columns, a roof, and a low wall, and he would have the wall decorated with paintings of all the creatures of the sea. He would have songs and stories invented about her, and would wonder if her sea friends grieved. They did, for a while, remembering her as Rusalka, you know, the one who was cracked. And he would never let her memory die. He forced himself to look at her. Rusalka's gills were opening and shutting wildly. She was staggering over the marble floor of the throne room, jerking about the way the fish will flop about when you take it out of the water. He tried to say something to her, that he was really sorry, that they could start over, that she could change back if she liked, that at last he saw her as she was, and that he knew she was beautiful among her own people. He took hold of her arm. Her extra eyelid went up, leaving her eyes blank. She tried to speak in the thin, bright air, but all that came out was a feeble hissing sound. Then, in spite of the pain, for she was drowning in the air, Rusalka managed to say one word, the only word she had ever spoken to him. She meant it for the both of them. "Fool," she said. And at his feet she bowed, she fell, she lay down. At his feet she bowed, she fell, she lay down, dead. That was Rusalka, or The Sea Coast of Bohemia, by Joanna Russ. And that is in an anthology called Don't Bet on the Prince, Contemporary Feminist Fairy Tales in North America and England, edited by Jack Zipes. Now, as a companion piece to that, showing another version of how ill land people and sea people can live together, but switching the sexes around, a story by Jane Yolen from a book called The Hundredth Dove and Other Tales, called The Lady and the Merman. Once in a house overlooking the cold northern sea, a baby was born. She was so plain, her father, a sea captain, remarked on it. She shall be a burden, he said. She shall be on our hands forever. Then, without another glance at the child, he sailed off in his great ship. His wife, who had longed to please him, was so hurt by his complaint that she soon died of it. Between one voyage and the next, she was gone. When the captain came home and found this out, he was so enraged he never spoke of his wife again. In this way, he convinced himself that her loss was nothing. But the girl lived and grew as if to spite her father. She looked little like her dead mother, but instead had the captain's face set round with mouse-brown curls. Yet as plain as her face was, her heart was not. She loved her father, but was not loved in return. And still the captain remarked on her looks. He said at every meeting, God must have wanted me cursed to give me such a child. No one will have her. She shall never be wed. She shall be with me forever. So he called her Born, for she was his burden. Born grew into a lady and only once gave a sign of this hurt. Father, she said one day when he was newly returned from the sea, what can I do to heal this wound between us? He looked away from her, for he could not bear to see his own face mocked in hers, and spoke to the cold stone floor. There is nothing between us, daughter, he said, but if there were, I would say salt for such wounds. Salt? Bourne asked, surprised, for she knew the sting of it. A sailor's balm, he said, the salt of tears or the salt of sweat or the final salt of the sea. Then he turned from her and was gone next day to the furthest port he knew of, and in this way he cleansed his heart. After this, Bourne never spoke again of the hurt. Instead, she carried it silently like a dagger inside. For the salt of tears did not salve her, so she turned instead to work. She baked bread in her ovens for the poor, she nursed the sick, she held the hands of the sea widows. But always, late in the evening, she walked on the shore looking and longing for a sight of her father's sail. Only, less and less often did he return from the sea. One evening, tired from the work of the day, Bourne felt faint as she walked on the strand. Finding a rock half in and half out of the water, she climbed upon it to rest. She spread her skirts about her, and in the dusk they lay like great gray waves. How long she sat there, still as the rock, she did not know. But a strange pale moon came up. And as it rose, so too rose the little creatures of the deep. They leaped free for a moment of the pull of the tide. And, last of all, up from the depths, came the merman. He rose out of the crest of the wave, seafoam crowning his green-black hair. His hands were raised high above him, and the webbings of his fingers were colorless as the air. In the moonlight, he seemed to stand upon his tail. Then, with a flick of it, he was gone, gone back to the deeps. He thought no one had remarked his dive. But Bourne had. So silent and still, she saw it all, his beauty and his power. She saw him and loved him, though she loved the fish half of him more. It was all she could dare. She could not tell what she felt to a soul, for she had no one who cared about her feelings. Instead, she forsook her work and walked by the sea both morning and night. Yet, strange to say, she never once looked for her father's sail. That is why her father returned one day without her knowing it. He watched her through slotted eyes as she paced the shore, for he would not look straight upon her. And at last he went to her and said, "Be done with it. Whatever ails you, give it over." For even he could see this wound. Bourne looked up at him, her eyes shimmering with small seas. Grateful even for this attention, she answered, "Yes, father, you are right. I must be done with it." The captain turned and left her then, for his food was growing cold. But Bourne went directly to the place where the waves were creeping up to the shore. She called out in a low voice, "Come up. Come up and be my love." There was no answer except for the shrieking laughter of the birds as they dove into the sea. So she took a stick and wrote the same words upon the sand for the merman to see should he ever return. Only as she watched, the creeping tide erased her words one by one by one. Soon there was nothing left of her cry on that shining strand. So Bourne sat herself down on the rock to weep, and each tear was an ocean. But the words were not lost. Each syllable washed from the beach was carried below, down, down, down to the deeps of the cool, inviting sea. And there below on his coral bed, the merman saw her words and came. He was all day swimming up to her. He was half the night seeking that particular strand. But when he came, cresting the currents, he surfaced with a mighty splash below Bourne's rock. The moon shone down on the two, she a grave shadow perched upon a stone, and he all motion and light. Bourne reached down with her white hands, and he caught them in his. It was the only touch she could remember. She smiled to see the web stretched taut between his fingers. He laughed to see hers webless, thin, small. One great pull between them and he was up by her side. Even in the dark she could see his eyes on her under the phosphorescence of his hair. He sat all night by her, and Bourne loved the man of him as well as the fish then, for in the silent night it was all one. Then, before the sun could rise, she dropped her hands on his chest. "Can you love me?" she dared to ask at last. But the merman had no tongue to tell her above the waves. He could only speak below the water with his hands, a soft murmuration. So, wordlessly, he stared into her eyes and pointed to the sea. Then, with the sun just rising beyond the rim of the world, he turned, dove arrow slim into a wave and was gone. Gathering her skirts, now heavy with ocean spray and tears, Bourne stood up. She cast but one glance at the shore and her father's house beyond. Then she dove after the merman into the sea. The sea put bubble jewels in her hair and spread her skirts about her like a scallop shell. Tiny colored fish swam in between her fingers. The water cast her face in silver, and all the sea was reflected in her eyes. She was beautiful for the first time and for the last.
People may come, people may go, but just as long as the water rainbow wood. Setting there, she takes a peep from her hair, plucks the colors one by one as she plays it to the sun. When will she learn that fantasy is only real? Can she believe in what she sees and what she feels?
Yes, I know what that sounded like, but that album is so rare and so special that I just had to do that. I'm sorry. It's that was a song called Rainbow Wood, and the album is called The Cake, as in chocolate, devil's food, angel, whatever. They're a group of, I think, three women from the 60s, 65, somewhere in there. Some of the songs on the album were written by Mac Rebennack, better known as Dr. John. The whole thing was arranged by Mac Rebennack. And it's a curious mix on this album of wall of sound, Phil Spector type, Ronettes, girl group, jive, regular, you know, run-of-the-mill 50s and early 60s stuff, but there's some special songs like that one on there. And like I said, it's too arcane and strange and rare an album for me not to have played it. I realize how very distorted and crackly it was, but it's been around for a long time. And as some of us know, when you're around for a long time, you start sounding like that. It is 6:55 on a Sunday morning, and I'm going to be leaving at 7. And let me just say before I go that my name is Sharon Griffiths, and this is a show called Heresy, where radio speaks with a woman's voice and speaks and speaks and yells and screams and laughs and has a wonderful time. I do have a wonderful time here. I read this morning some feminist fairy tales, fairy stories, myths, legends, something. And I will be doing that for the next 3 weeks on this show. If you would like to write me, please do. The address here is WBAI 505 8th Avenue, New York 10018. And my name again is Sharon, S-H-A-R-O-N, Griffiths, G-R-I-F-F-I-T-H-S, as in Sam. And I will be back next week with more feminist stories, fables, whatever. And until then, take good care of yourself, and I'll see you, or I'll talk to you at least, in about a week's time. Thank you so much for listening. Send postcards. Send letters. This is my subliminal advertising and message to you. Send correspondence to me. I like it. Bye now. Thank you.
If you missed the Creative Unity Collective show on...
show on radio. Then, at 9:30, hear of a Sunday morning, early music with literate, loving commentary from Chris Wendt. So, start the week right with Through the Opera Glass from 7 to 9:30 a.m. and Chris Wendt's Hear of a Sunday Morning from 9:30 to 11:30. Some of the best music in New York on listener-sponsored WBAI New York 99.5 FM.
The weather for today, Sunday the 16th, 1991, will be warm and clear. You've got your dial set to 99.5 FM WBAI in New York. The time is 7 a.m. Through the Opera Glass is a weekly feature of this station. Today's host is Manya. And now, Through the Opera Glass with Manya.